Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to Daniel Kirsch, who is the author of Sold My Soul for a Student Loan, Higher Education and the Political Economy of the Future. The book is published by Prager, and I have Daniel on the phone right now. Daniel, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you, Heath. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great, and glad to have you on the line to talk about the book and talk about yourself. And before we get to this very, very timely topic and your very, very timely book, maybe you can just share just a little bit about yourself.
Sure, happy to. I received my education at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and now I teach at California State University at Sacramento. And in the intervening time, I had a long grad school career, and I have myself accumulated student debt, but this is, I should say, not a memoir. I went out of my way to kind of contextualize this in terms of, a political crisis. It's been interesting so far. But as far as myself is concerned, I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast about 3 years ago. So I think I'm still under jet lag at this point.
Okay, good. And so you're on East Coast time as I sit here and record. Let's talk about this book, it's hard to imagine a listener of this podcast not having some sense of positive, negative, or otherwise. Probably not the same take that you have. Your book is about the politics of the student loan programs and their consequences. You refer to this in the book as the student debt crisis. Why do you characterize it in this way? And what convinces you that in the U.S. there in fact is a crisis situation related to student debt?
It's a good question. There's really no precedent for this type of debt in our history up until this point. And just the numbers that I think everyone is familiar with by now, to get us up to speed, is about 12 years ago, the total student loan debt in the U.S. was under $300 billion. And today it's, at $1.6 trillion and counting by most estimates. So we're in a moment where the emerging generation has an average student debt once they leave college of about $30,000. And that just creates a whole new set of variables in the lives of the new kind of emerging political class. And it also just totally differently situates our social conversation around education and around democracy. So it's a crisis because it's something that we did not at all thoughtfully prepare for, and it's objectively a problem that at the individual level certainly always needs to be solved, but at a social level is reaching crisis proportion simply because of the number of people affected and the degree to which they're affected.
So as you allude, this crisis is not just financial or individual, it's also political in many ways. Who are the primary political actors in this environment? Students are an obvious group, but who else plays a part in the development and implementation of this policy and really the political economy that you describe in your title?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are several. There are a lot of players in this world, and that's part of what I discovered in my research. First of all, I mean, the most prominent players are certainly the lenders themselves. And that's, you know, there are only three or four major lenders, and in addition to the federal government themselves. So those are people who are directly profiting from the student debt crisis, and they're actively, you know, lobbying to maintain the status quo of the way that the student loan system is set up. Of course, for-profit colleges and universities are huge players in this. I had a great, interesting conversation with journalist David Halpern in my research for this book that I mostly fully outline in the book. And he explained to me just what the business model of for-profit higher education is, which is essentially get all your tuition dollars in the form of federal student aid, and basically pocket most of the money and only spend a pittance on education. So, and take the most of it in stock dividends. So for-profit higher education banks, certainly the students themselves are players, although really not consciously or most of the time, at least for undergraduates, willingly. But of course, higher education itself, right? Universities, public and private, are a huge player in this. And one person I spoke to mentioned that he was disappointed that the state university systems had become complicit in the student loan crisis because they had basically bargained with the state legislature that they could keep most of their programs despite declining state aid, as long as they were allowed to raise their tuition and fees substantially in a way that really was at a much faster pace than it had been historically. So aside from those kind of major players, I would say that all of us are affected because there's about 45 million people with student debt. And I would wager that very few of us don't know anyone who doesn't have substantial student debt in their young adult life.
So I wonder if you could place us in time a little bit. This isn't always been the case. Crises tend not to last forever. What is your starting point here? Not the book. This is not the approach you take. But if we were to think about this, when does the crisis start approximately?
Really around the same time as the financial crisis is when the student loan crisis really kicks into high gear. It had been emerging in the 1990s. All of the factors I mentioned were already in place by the year 2000, certainly, but they really were accelerated by the financial crisis. When state legislatures in 2008, 2009, state legislatures like Arizona and many others substantially cut their state funding for higher education in a way that really compelled, as I mentioned, most of the public universities to keep their programs. But because most people were going to college and university in a down economy, but instead they decided to raise their tuition and they relied on this existing framework of student loan and aid, and that they had relied on already. But it just ballooned in a way that no one was really prepared for, because people were going to school because there was no job market for them in the immediate aftermath of college in, say, 2008, 2009. So as far as in a linear fashion, that's when you started to see this whole confluence of factors. But it really, the germ of all of it had begun much earlier, certainly in the 90s. That framework was in place, but we've been changing our understanding of how higher education works in this country since certainly about World War II and the GI Bill. And, you know, other scholars like Suzanne Mettler in Degrees of Inequality talked quite a bit about how the GI Bill really gave impetus to, you know, the modern idea of the American dream and American citizenship, because it empowered so many people to go to college tuition free. But also, you know, in that era, we were seeing a really flush economy in the U.S. that we were not afraid to spend money on building an infrastructure of public higher education. And so more people were going to to college and universities in the 1950s and 60s and 70s than ever had before. And so in order to kind of maintain that system, we haven't decided to abandon it. Most of our job market is now dependent on people receiving a higher education. We just haven't given any thought to adequately funding it. We've just pushed the costs onto the consumer and allowed them to take out essentially unlimited amounts of credit to pay for it.
So you describe your book as a political ethnography. What do you mean by this? And what does it mean you did to conduct the research for the book? This is a little different than what people might expect of somebody interested in finance to approach this in an ethnographic way. So tell us about what you did.
Sure. Well, I should say at the outset that I'm not always interested in finance. That's part of the reason probably I ended up with student debt myself. But I think the way that I approached this initially was I had put down my dissertation in 2014, 2015, and I had decided that I really wanted to find out what the political context surrounding this federal government policy that I was involved in was all about. And one of the first resources I found were all of these online testimonial websites that had hundreds and hundreds each of student testimonials and borrower testimonials of essentially detailing their entire student loan debt story and how they had started and how they had ended. And it was all of these people who were so concerned that they didn't know what else to do besides on the internet. It's essentially like screaming into the void. And, you know, this it had really started in earnest around the time of the financial crisis and subsequently during Occupy Wall Street, when a lot of these websites popped up as well. But I had seen that one or two people, Jeffrey Williams among them, had already written a few pieces about this and just kind of had mined some of these stories and in a positive way had really given a voice to some of these people. And I did a little bit of research around that. I did a little bit of cataloging of what their what the kind of crude content analysis around some of the keywords were in their testimonials and things like the American dream and never being able to pay it off and wanting forgiveness and that kind of thing. And I decided I wanted to go a little bit in a different direction in some more depth. So I began to interview not only people who were borrowers, because I had found many of the themes already in some of the borrower testimonials, but I realized that this was a whole world that in order to understand it, one really had to go in and talk to all the people who inhabit it. So I decided to talk to some policy elites, some policymakers. I spoke to lobbyists, journalists, attorneys, borrowers themselves, certainly, and activists, a couple of higher education administrators. And in addition, I talked to some politicians. So all of these people were active in some way around the issue of student debt. One person, indeed, was Adolf Reed, who was who was really a leader in the kind of free higher education movement in the 90s and post 2000s. And so attacking it from the other way, like what is the alternative to having high tuition and fees and high student loan debt? It's to having no tuition and fees and no student loan debt. So all these people who in many ways had engaged with this issue, I heard from their perspective. And it really is a fascinating, you know, I consider myself as much a reader of this book as a writer of it, because all of these interviews that I did, I excerpted really the most interesting parts of them and included it in the book and, you know, included essentially some analytic commentary to kind of sandwich all of the interviews. And so when I say it's an ethnography, I mean it in a, you know, as much of a the in some ways the loosest sense of the word. It kind of passed muster in terms of my methods chapter, but basically I just mean it as a way that I stepped into a world and I decided to talk to everyone there that I could find and that I could get connected with. And they were all fascinating. And one thing that I want to share as an insight that I think I gleaned that I wouldn't have if I hadn't done this kind of research, is that despite their perspective, attorneys who assisted people, policymakers who were active on the issue, and people who were saddled with this debt, and people who were not necessarily even sympathetic towards towards student debtors also, they still all said virtually the same thing, which is that this is a cohort of people who did everything right or did everything that we asked them to do. They were people that took out debt to get an education, to better themselves, to contribute to society. And to have that same cohort of people essentially sentenced to, you know, a lifelong debt that kind of that really hampers their ability to participate in our traditional political and economic system is really is maybe the crisis portion of it, or the policy disjunction, if you will, that occurred as a result of all of these confluence of factors.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's talk about just that. We typically think of higher education working the exact opposite way, empowering people in all sorts of ways, financially and politically and democratically. But you're finding your argument is for the opposite. When you talk to people for the book who were facing large student debt, how did they talk about politics, and how did they talk about their feelings of empowerment or disempowerment? Did they connect it to the student debt that they were facing, or did they connect it to the policies that led them to that? What's the way in which this is happening out there in the communities and with the people that you spoke with?
Well, people usually settle on one or another of several emotions when talking to them about their stories. I know that one person basically has that comes to mind to get at your question, saw that student debt was really a Mount Olympus to him, that he would never get there to be able to pay it off. And he kind of blamed his entire social world. Like, everyone told him to get an education. And he also did not feel charitably towards politicians who said to kind of at all costs to obtain a higher education kind of certification. Others really were, it depended on what, there's no really direct answer to that question, because they all had different places that they focused their concern. But many of the policymakers focused their kind of attention on just the process and the bargains that were made to kind of get through the financial crisis. Others really focused, like David Halpern, as I mentioned, talked about for-profit colleges and universities. Alexis Goldstein, who's a prominent kind of journalist and activist, has focused her attention on the fact that a lot of this is a parallel to, and indeed sort of a shadow of, the mortgage lending crisis. And so her attention is focused on the big banks. And so most of the way that people end up feeling about higher education is disappointment. And as a believer and participant, of course, myself in higher education, this is very troubling because I know, and you know, all of us who are, you know, faculty in higher education have devoted our careers and our lives to this idea that it is empowering and that it is something that we should encourage people to do. And I still certainly believe that. And I think there's no reason after reading my book, you wouldn't still believe that. But I think that what we have to be aware of is that the way in which we're doing it ends up having more of a cost to people than I think we anticipate or even fully contextualize while people are undertaking their education. So, for example, in the system that I teach in California, you know, students are already working 30-hour work weeks on average, and they take, you know, between 4 and 6 years to graduate. I think 6 years is the average. And so, you know, to put people in that kind of a situation where we expect them to only be working part-time during their youth while they're paying rent, and while many of the students in my state are food and housing insecure as well, and we expect them to shoulder this entire burden without taking on substantial student loan debt, is really just is wishful thinking. So I don't think that most people will read this and say, well, we need to get out of higher education. I think most people will see that everyone here that I interviewed appreciates the need for it, and sees its value in creating really high level citizenry. But I do think that what it calls attention to most is that we are without too much thought and attention entirely shifting the cost to people who haven't reckoned with what that cost means or have the ability to pay it. So that's where I think it actually points.
Yeah, no, this book isn't primarily about campaign politics and what have you, but it's hard to imagine something as important as this to a pretty specific group of people wouldn't have resonance in campaigns. How do you connect this to the current conversation happening at a national level about higher education and higher education reform and student debt reform? Is this something that's likely to change, or is will the crisis result in something much more disastrous before policymakers change these policies that create the environment you describe?
I mean, I certainly hope not, right? I certainly hope that this crisis is resolved in some positive way that everyone sees value in. So to answer that, in my final chapter, I talk about the precedent of presidents being able to issue some sort of amnesty in the case of in 1986 when President Reagan issued an amnesty partnered with Congress for undocumented immigrants, when Jimmy Carter and Ford before him had issued a pardon for people who had evaded the Vietnam era draft, and debt forgiveness has actually been quite a theme in American politics since the Nixon presidency, and virtually every president has engaged in some form of targeted debt forgiveness itself. So all of this is not without precedent, the kind of discussion that I think is going on right now in the presidential campaign about some type of large scale or wide scale debt forgiveness. And I think it's I will take credit for being a little bit predictive in the book, because I was researching and writing most of this in 2015, 16, 17. Most of the people who I talk about, the politicians I discussed, are people who have been leaders on this issue, and those are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. I should mention also, in fairness to Joe Biden, one of the things that is in his history is that he co-sponsored this kind of bankruptcy reform bill in 2005, and that certainly didn't allow student loan borrowers discharge their debt in bankruptcy. But Elizabeth Warren in the past has talked about not taking in revenue for the federal government as student loan interest payment in the form of student loan interest payments. saying, you know, we don't want it. We don't want this extra revenue. It's essentially a tax on people who have taken out loans for their higher education. And certainly Bernie Sanders has called for, in the past, he called for just free higher education without specifically targeting student loans. So I will take some additional credit in saying that the book was published on April 1st of this year. And I believe on April, I want to say 27th or so, Sanders came out with that announcement that he was calling in his platform for total abolition of student loan debt after he's you know, elected president. So so I think I had talked about this in the book as kind of a, you know, an ideal solution. But in fact, it's really in and of itself, I take no credit for that. In and of itself, it's become really a talking point for the major kind of political leaders of our day. And even President Trump has felt compelled to weigh in on it and has talked about, you know, the need for some kind of long-term debt forgiveness policy. He did in a speech in 2016. He hasn't followed through with any of it, of course, but he certainly has given some lip service to it. So, yeah, and there's also these two programs that are an ongoing concern and interest to everyone with student loan debt, especially the majority of people who have it with the federal government, but also people who have it with banks have created some income-based repayment. And most of the debt that's being repaid right now is either income-based repayment or is not substantially contributing to paying down anyone's balances. So another reason it's a crisis is because, you know, it's not getting any lower. People aren't paying it off. And if we can actually digest that as a society, we should really be taking steps to, you know, go ahead and try to solve it in a public policy way that's more coherent. So income-based repayment is one solution that's been kind of a stopgap that's been around for about 10 years. But it's kind of sunsetted because after 25 years, you're supposed to have all of your debt forgiven, but the balance is supposed to be counted as taxable income. So we have yet to see that kind of come to fruition, another 12 or 13 years, I suppose. But if we do, I think we could see kind of a secondary crisis. But anyway, there's public service loan forgiveness is the second program that is really come under scrutiny lately, because we do have people who have applied for public service loan forgiveness. And for those who aren't familiar, it's a program that allows you to combine your income-based repayment with working, you know, supposedly in a relatively moderate income job for the government or a charity for 10 years. And then if you make 120 payments and they don't have to be consecutive, you can be forgiven for not only the balance of your debt, but also that taxable income. And so it sounds great. And it kind of works as a policy solution, except that only about 5,000 people have applied for it. But less than 100 have been granted it. So 99% of people have been rejected for what they thought was going to be an accurate application to their public service loan forgiveness program. So right now it's a very dysfunctional program, and there are lawsuits from teachers and lawyers who made financial decisions based on their participation in this program. So there's just an ongoing kind of mess of public policy problems that are just beginning to emerge. And it's, you know, the political kind of leadership is now just beginning to address it and being really forced to address it in several ways in their platforms. And as I always say, when people ask me about this topic and why did I decide to research it, I just say, well, it's here and it's definitely not going away anytime soon.
The book again is Sold My Soul for a Student Loan, Higher Education and the Political Economy of the Future. The author who you've been hearing from is Daniel Kirsch, and the publisher is Prager. Daniel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. It's been a pleasure.